Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, I'd encourage you, if you could, to move down to this front part of the theater. Mr. Jackson is going to be using an easel, as I mentioned a minute ago, and it could be fairly difficult to see from way back in the depths of the theater. This morning's topic is the importance of research in directing your program, and our guest speaker is, of course, Mr. Patrick Jackson, APR. Mr. Jackson has a vantage point for viewing public relations, which must be unique. He edits one of the standard publications in the field, PR Reporter. He is a senior member of the counseling firm Jackson, Jackson & Wagner, which he formed in 1956. He is also an adjunct professor at Boston University's School of Public Communication, the world's first school of public relations. And he is past a national president of the Public Relations Society of America. In addition, a 1978 poll of practitioners named him one of the 20 most respected PR professionals in the United States. He is also listed in Who's Who in America. Mr. Jackson is a public official, an authority on land use and related issues, and a registered lobbyist. In 1964, Mr. Jackson's firm moved to Epping, New Hampshire, where it occupies a house built in 1713 on a dirt dead-end road looking off a mountain, but 30 miles from two international airports. His firm specializes in attitude change and reinforcement on significant social issues, and besides corporations and associations, JJ&W has always represented movements and has had a hand in organizing several of them. A frustrated author, Mr. Jackson has written four books, all of which appeared over clients' bylines. His wife is also an accredited public relations counselor. Her name is Isabel Park, APR. Together, they are returning an abandoned New Hampshire farm to production, primarily commercial blueberries, and raise most of their family's food. Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Ken. I've spoken to a number of case meetings in the past, and since all good public relations begins with research, I want to do a little. How many of you here have heard me talk before? Now, let me turn that around. How many of you here have not heard me talk before? How many of you don't give a damn? I was afraid of that. I want to do a little additional kind of research, because I know right now, if the psychology of meetings is working, that you're kind of researching me. I see a lot of you are sitting back there in the escape seats, just in case. And so let me tell you that I do not come to you as someone with no experience in higher education. I do represent, I and my firm represent, a number of institutions of higher education as well as secondary education. We have for a number of years, and I think I know what your problems are. I certainly know what my clients' problems are, and I have got some pretty definite ideas about ways that research can deal with those problems. I would be less than honest, however, if I did not say that it is one of the great ironies to me of our practice, or at least of our personal practice, that academic institutions founded and based on scholarship and research have to be far and away those clients, in my experience, that resist using research in their administration and in their programs. You may have an answer to that. I don't. But I think it's something that those of us who practice on behalf of higher education have to give a great deal of thought to in the present climate, because it seems to me that research still has that basic function that it always has had in an administrative sense, and that is, research increases the precision of decision. That's one of those nice little bon mots that consultants like to come up with, but I think you'll agree it's not bad, you know, increases the precision of decision. College presidents can probably even understand that, given a little, you know, supporting materials. The problem is, and this may be the reason that academic institutions have been somewhat resistive, in my experience, of research in their public relations programs, is that you have to believe that human relations problems are as specific and researchable as other problems. And so I guess each of us has to ask ourselves, do we believe that human research, that human relations problems can be researched? If you disagree with that, I hope to do a little bit of convincing in the next hour. Someone once said that research is listening, and I'd also like to try at least to convince you that that really is a good deal of what it's about. It's a funny, I don't know if it's funny, it's odd at least, that one of the better practitioners that I know in North America is a person who happens to represent a very large public school district. And after some 25 years of practice, this person has, as we all do, written down his experiences and has come to summarize all relationship activities as being something like this. See, you in the back can't read this, it serves you right. I'm not sure I agree with those numbers, but what he says is that about 90% of his practice over the years, he has found to be the simple act of listening, and he includes formal research or informal research in that. About 7% is the internal relationships that he is able to build, and about 3% is external communications. Now that may be a statement that seems hyperbolic to you, but I put it to you as the experience of someone that I respect highly. The man's name is Bill Bonnick. He happens to be the president this year of the National School Public Relations Association, and a person who has done a great deal to apply behavioral sciences to the practice of public relations. I was asked not long ago in talking to a college audience, students of public relations, what I thought would be the single most important word in public relations in the next 20 years. Only students can ask a question like that. I thought about it for a long time. What one word is going to be the real bellwether? And finally, it was pretty easy to decide. I decided that that word is going to be evidence. We, in any aspect of public relationships, are going to have to come to grips with the word evidence. Nobody wants our opinions anymore. What we need is some evidence that our programs, our plans, are going to produce results, or evidence afterwards that they have produced results. To me, that means research. I should add, by the way, that I have been a critic of CASE and CASE conferences on occasion. Some of you probably know that. But I'm really proud of its recent efforts to lead members to research. The May-June issue of Currents, I found excellent. A lot of really good material in there. If yours is still in the pile back home, you may want to dig it out when you get there. I think it's an excellent research topic. I'm also pleased at the two books that CASE has published recently, Jenny Carter's excellent book on readership surveys and Walt Lindemann's on general attitude in public relations research. But I have to ask myself, with such materials available, and they have been around for a long time, not these particular publications or issues, but this kind of material has been around for a long time. Why have we been so loath to do the research that we know we need? Well, money is one reason. I think that, let me ask you this. How many of you here have in your budgets a line item for research? A very, very small percentage of the audience. Obviously, that's a problem. I guess what this illustrates, in addition to the need to dedicate funds, is that we need to learn less expensive, informal research techniques that will enable us to get the evidence without having to expend the dollars. And I want to spend quite a good deal of time on those kind of informal techniques. Secondly, I think that lack of training for many of us has been a barrier. I've been working with one Canadian institution on putting together an ideal public relations course based in the behavioral sciences. And the one integer in that course that we've had the most difficulty with is a course on research. How much research should public relations practitioners know? Must we be statisticians? Do we have to know the statistical package for the social sciences? And I think that most of us put face to face with those kind of questions would probably have to admit that our own backgrounds have not prepared us for that. And this then makes us very vulnerable to people who sell research. And I have to plead guilty. Our consulting firm has a subsidiary that does research, Dudley Research. And I have to admit the real inability sometimes of our clients to judge what we are telling them. So certainly our lack of training is a problem. Fear of the unknown may be another. Many of us have never undertaken a real research project on our own daily work. And we certainly dislike buying the books and doing it by rote. If we have some of that fear of the unknown, let me then begin by just quickly outlining, as a reminder to us all, what can be researched and what the basic method of public relations research is. Fortunately, there are only four areas of public relations research. There are four areas in which we can hope to learn something. And if we keep those in mind, it at least narrows the horizons, helps us to focus on our work. We can research people's attitudes. Notice that I do not use the word opinion. In our particular case, we have not used opinion research for about 10 years. I think it is untrustworthy. Our experience is that it is misleading. And worst of all, like all research, it is historical. Because obviously, if we gather the data on Wednesday and analyze it on Thursday, it is already yesterday's opinion. Since opinions are so flighty and so changing, we try, and try is the operative word, we try to deal with attitudes, to get behind the opinions. Secondly, even more valuable, we can research people's behavior, how they really act, what do they really do, as opposed, of course, to what their attitudes are and to what they say. Thirdly, obviously, there's a category of demographic research. We're all familiar with that. How many, when, how much income, that kind of question. And fourthly, there's a category of environmental research, having to do with the interactive patterns. What groups does one travel in? What are the relationships in these groups? What are the lifestyles? Who are your neighbors? The kind of questions that alumni and development people, I think, within our university, college, public relations spectrum have been far more conscious of than those of us who may be dealing in public information or institutional relations. Those are the only four areas, or at least those are four areas, in which we can categorize research for public relations purposes. The methodology for all of those is approximately the same. There's a six-step method, and most of you, I hope, are familiar with this. But let me just repeat it in case, because the actual techniques that I want to share with you later are all based on an understanding of these basics. The first step in the research process is called the statement. The statement is really nothing more than a plan of the research. In other words, what do we want to find out? What do we need to know? But I would have to say, from my experience, that this is the part that causes the most problem. And I think this is one of the reasons that many of us get burned by bad research and then may shy away from it in future. In order for a research project to be effective, we have just learned through experience that as a matter of course,
you have to first go through the difficult exercise of sitting down and writing on paper, what do I need to know? And some folks find it easier to do it another way. This is the problem, or this is the opportunity. And what I need to solve it or capitalize on it is, and then write it out. It's a very disciplining technique. And when one is done, usually you find a number of things. A lot of what we would like to know, it is probably unrealistic to try to find out. So the statement helps to narrow down the research. Other times we find that we're a little murky ourselves on what we need to know. And so before we plunge in, having the discipline to do a statement leads us to research that will be useful rather than merely research for the sake of research. The second step is to define the universe. Is the universe all of our alumni? Is it alumni and neighbors? That alumni, neighbors, and the legislature. What is the total body of persons that we want to know their attitudes, behaviors, demographics, or environment? Once we know the universe, and I must say that this is rarely a difficult problem in university or in college research, because usually we are dealing with specific bodies, the voting public, our alumni, prospective students, parents, some group that we can quickly define. The third problem then, the third step, is choosing the sample. Now therein lies one of the great, probably the great, cost difficulty in research. I want to talk about that more later, but let me for the moment simply say that we have been so brainwashed to believe in absolutely statistically provable samples that I think we have gone totally overboard. Many times when we are, any of us, doing a survey, for example, of the legislature, let's say, or of a specific, relatively smaller element, maybe the staff of a department or a college, maybe the whole university, there are a tremendous number of benefits to doing a 100% sample, particularly on internal kind of studies. If you're doing an employee relations study and you use a statistical sample, is the result that you get going to be more beneficial than the questions you're going to raise in the minds of those who didn't get the questionnaire? It's a very real problem. I have spent weeks putting out the fire of, what did they ask me? You know, is it a pink slip neck? You see? Susie got one and I did. Sampling is the key to cost, the key to effectiveness, and we'll talk about that some more. The next portion is the questionnaire. What specifically are we going to ask in order to elicit responses that will give us trustworthy information? And I'm sure I needn't tell you that our techniques today are so sophisticated that many of the major polls have not just theoretical examples, but file examples of the exact same questionnaire administered in the exact same way, with one or two words changed, and a totally different result. This is one of the dangers of research, and we'll get into that a little bit more later. The next step is, still goes by the quaint name field work. And what it means, of course, is administering your questionnaire, your research document, as the professionals like to say in order to keep the prices high, administering your research document to the sample. It's called field work because, of course, when the research of this type began, it meant going out into the field and knocking on doors and asking people, would they mind? Today, there is an ordinance in New York City against going out and knocking on doors and asking people if they would mind, because we have had quite a change in the environment, let us say, in which research is conducted. And so field work has now taken on tremendous importance. From just being a detail a few years ago, it has now become one of the key ingredients of success. The turndown rates on all types of research today are very, very high. I'm sure you're familiar with that. If you've done any research, you've probably had that problem. Even in tight in-house bodies, like surveying the alumni, the returns are often disappointing. And so field work has taken on a great importance. There are a number of answers to that. Generally, as I'll talk about in a minute, we do not limit ourselves to a single type of field work. If we're doing a mailing of a questionnaire, we will pick a sample of the sample to question by telephone. First of all, to keep the number of responses up, and secondly, to get a check against the mail reply, but I'll talk about that in a minute. The sixth and final step is, of course, analysis. Did I get anything for all this effort after analyzing the returns that is really going to help me deal with my problems? I have a couple of biases, and let me inject them right here now so you won't be caught off guard by them. The first is that statistical considerations are far less critical than the questions that we ask. In this process, I am not as concerned anymore, based on daily work and research, in the statistical analysis to get an absolutely perfect sample, as I am on asking questions that will really give me the answers that I want. If you put your effort into the statistics, you may have mathematically correct garbage. And I have got a drawer full of it, despite our very best efforts. So even though we are aware of that problem, the questionnaire today is such a difficulty. To show you how specialized this has become, there's a group in Iowa that now has computer readings on 7,000 words and can tell you at the moment, the general public conception, the connotation of that word for use in research. So at least we're making an attempt to deal with it, but I think their mere existence proves my point. And so if you hear me talking more about how you ask than about the statistics, that's because I have learned to have that bias. Secondly, I have come to have a great mistrust of what the public is willing to respond to us today. It's odd I should say that when I'm here trying to convince you I hope to do more research. So I'm really just offering it as a warning. I teach a research course at BU, and one of the things I do every year is to make up an absolutely mythical issue and send students into the streets to do what we call intercept interviews. Again, that's high-priced rhetoric. It really means stopping people on the street and asking them questions. But if we call it intercept interviews, that gives a kind of a credibility to it for clients. I send them on the street to do intercept interviews on some absolutely mythical issue, and the no-answer rate is always about 5 to 7%. The other 93 to 95% were perfectly willing to express their opinion on an issue that didn't even exist. Because people today, as we become more self-confident, better educated society, people don't want to admit that they don't know. And so therefore, rather than saying, I don't know, they will give you an opinion. Very dangerous. Plus, we have found that if you're going to ask questions, this questionnaire part here, it really consists of two steps. One is the question itself, and two is what we call checking questions. So that if question six asks a specific piece of information, question 14 is probably going to ask for that same information in a slightly different way in order to check against question six, so that in analyzing the return, we can sort out the garbage. In field work, as I mentioned earlier, the same. We rarely use one type of field work. Yes?
Excuse me, on this checking question, you have question six, select one way, Question 14, same question, expressed a different way. But it just, it's where somebody says yes on question 6 and no on question 14. You just eliminate that.
Well, usually, if it's an absolute dichotomy like that, we will toss it out.
Okay.
At least we will note that there is this dichotomy. It gives us a bit of a handle on the research. I'm going into some of this detail now because I think it's necessary we share, you at least know where I'm coming from. So when I talk about some of the methods we're using, you'll see the efforts that we're making to try, in a society which is sharing so much information that accuracy has become really very little value, and how in that kind of society can we do research that will be trustworthy enough for us to base programs on. As I pointed out, we do the same thing in field work. If it's a mail survey, we do some telephoning, and if it's a telephone survey, we do some intercept interviewing to make sure that we're getting on the right track. All of this, of course, presupposes one other thing, and that is that for any kind of public relations activity, whether it's fundraising or working with alumni or recruiting or working on the reputation of your institution, there are four prerequisites that we have found. And the first one is some kind of attitudinal behavioral research. By the way, that's another kind of check-in question that we ask. We do a number of needs assessment studies for educational institutions. Right now, the military, despite this may sound familiar to you, despite the supposed largesse of the United States federal government toward the military, they are, of course, cutting budgets in many places. And one of the places that they're cutting budgets is in their educational system. Continuing education program, the Army, for example, has had its budget cut by about a third, while the guys next door making missiles have had theirs increased by 10 times. It tells us something about how our society values education. Because of this, they're doing a great deal of needs assessment work. In a needs assessment study, we might ask, what kind of course would you be interested in taking? Would you be interested in taking any courses? What kind? When would you be available? That sort of thing. And then we will ask, have you, in fact, ever taken a course? And if the answer to that is, well, no, we think that may be a little less valuable information, depending on the demographics of that person. Of course, if the person has just been in the service for 6 months, then we will consider that neutral. But if someone's been around 10 years and their history tells us they've been on bases where good courses have always been available, we know then that they are the typical American education shopper. We'd all love to spend some time in the classroom, but how many of us do? So we try to check the attitudinal responses against some behavioral measures. That kind of research is a prerequisite, it seems to us, of any kind of public relations activity. Secondly, another research form that is essential is some kind of a communications audit or a relationships audit. What, in fact, has been the effectiveness of your present methods of communicating and getting feedback from the audience that you are charged with dealing with? And what is the status of the understanding or the ignorance of that audience about what it is that you do or are trying to do? Thirdly, we don't see how anyone can operate without a long-range plan. How can I give evidence of the fact that I have accomplished something unless I have a plan to point back to say this is where I started and this is what I want to do? And finally, one needs an organizational structure which will make it possible to carry out the activities that you have set before you as a mission. I give this list of prerequisites for any kind of public relations activity merely to show that three of them are research-based. The original research itself, the communications or relationships audit, and certainly a long-range plan cannot be done effectively without a great deal of research. I hope it helps to make my point that indeed research is at the heart of it. Public Relations Society of America and my newsletter, PR Reporter, have been doing some research on research, and we are now making the estimate that for anyone who works in any area of public relationships, that about 60% of the workload today involves either research or, the flip side, evaluation. Let's talk a little bit about some of the uses now of this research. We've spoken of it as a prerequisite for programming. I want to talk a little bit about audits. Auditing what it is, in fact, that we have done. A communications audit, as I've listed here, is certainly an idea that I think anyone in a relationship function ought to give serious consideration to. I don't care whether you're raising funds, dealing with alumni, whatever you're involved in, that communications feedback function is essential to what we do. It just cannot occur, what we do cannot occur without that. And yet, how many of us have taken the time to audit that communications and feedback mechanism? Very few. How many of you here have done a communications audit on your program? As I said, very few. Well, then I think we have to ask ourselves, are we reaching them? Have we evidence that we are? Are they understanding us? Have we evidence that they are? Are we understanding them when they give us feedback? Or perhaps when they fail to give us feedback, are they telling us something? These are all questions each of us asks every day in our work. Well, there is a research method for dealing with that, a simple communications audit. Now, I know that a lot of you have probably been approached by people like myself who would be happy to do a communications audit for a cool $50,000 or $60,000, and that may have scared you off. I would suggest that you yourselves, with some third-party help, and it's very tough to do a communications audit without third-party help because you may not be the most unbiased researchers of your own programs. With some third-party help, you can probably do a communications audit for a fraction of that, maybe $4,000 or $5,000. Remember, the goal of the research is not to generate all these statistics, but to see if we can get a handle on these key questions. Are we communicating? A very small sample, not even statistically selected, of your audience, say it's alumni, a very small sample can be asked a uniform, and that's where the research comes in, a uniform set of questions about your programs. If you use just common sense care in choosing among that alumni universe, a sample which includes those who are quite active, very active, and inactive, so you know you're not just choosing the most active members of the Alumni Association to ask them what they know. Choosing even a very random sample can give you at least an indicator of whether or not your message is getting out there. So I would urge you to consider communications audits. There's another part of communications auditing that is really, you can do it yourself. And that is, at the end of a year, or 6 months, or choose your period, take all of the communications that you have put forth, all the publications, a sample of the letters that you've been writing. And today, with word processors, that's easy, because most of them end up being form letters anyway, with a personal paragraph at the beginning or end. Or if you aren't doing that, you must have a luxury of very great time on your hands, which I don't have. Take all of those communicated materials and simply put them through the fog test, the flesh test, any test that you like. If you're not familiar with the fog test, it was developed in 1944 by Robert Gunning. It takes a look at written materials and assigns, through a very simple formula, assigns to those materials a level of reading and comprehension difficulty. It's a marvelous document. Reader's Digest and Shakespeare and some other widely read materials, widely understood, come in somewhere around an 8th or a 9th grade reading level. Most of the university materials that we check thousands of pieces every year, most of the university materials come in right about PhD. And it's interesting that often the ones that are just a little over PhD level are the ones that are aimed at parents or sometimes at high school graduates that we would like to have come to our school. And here we have a research technique, a fog test, a flesh test, to tell us in advance. You can take all of your materials for the last year, apply one of these tests to them. How are you doing? Are you too formal? Are you using words that are too big? And you'll know right away part of the answer of whether you're communicating. It won't take you. I'll bet you if you and your staff sat down, gathered all the materials, just pulled them out of the files, and administered both of these tests as a joint project, I doubt it would take you 2 hours unless you are a prolific communicator, in which case you ought to do a little research about whether you are communicating too much. One of the great public relations disasters of the age. I think in a couple of hours you could apply that portion of a communications audit to your own program. You can also certainly, and I hope you do anyway, chart all the feedback that you get. Never mind being scientific about it. If Joe Blow passes you in the hall and says, how come you're doing so and so, go back on your chart and under dubious about certain program, put Joe Blow or one or however you want to chart it. When you get a bunch of letters in, you talk to people, just chart accurately as you can their responses, their feedback. It's amazing if you'll keep a nice piece of brown wrapping paper on the wall near your desk, write down all the things you're doing and chances for people to respond and just fill it in. It's amazing in 2 or 3 weeks even what indicators you will have. They're not scientific, absolutely not. But at least you've got some evidence, some indicator, which usually we don't have at the moment. I think that... The first test is the fog test.
F-O-G?
F-O-G, you know, just foggy writing. It's in a book written by Robert Dunning, D-U-N-N-I-G. I think it's called something like The Way to More Effective Writing or The Way to More Effective Reading or whatever. F-O-G. Gunning. G-U-N-N-I-N-G. Gee, if I had known you didn't all have this book, I would have brought a supply, and at $8.95, you know, you could have had it. Last I knew, it was only $8.95, obviously not printed by a textbook publisher. It's something like The Way to a More Effective Writing. Yes. Absolutely. If you take out those words whose meanings have lapsed through time and just deal with that which anybody today can understand, he's below eighth grade reading level. Who does what? Important point, except for one thing. I hope none of us are using words whose meaning has ceased to exist among our publics. And if Will were around, I have a hunch he would rewrite his scripts a little. The stuff he thought was kind of sexy, you know, really wouldn't make it today, and so he'd have to do all that over. Another point that I think it's important for us to make, and another use of research in a way that we have not faced up to before, is that there's a new way of dealing with this problem of getting people to tell us what they really believe. I said in the past we've had, let me explain it in another way. Public relations, as I said, used to be interested in opinions. And we still talk about the court of public opinion. Well, that's really a trite phrase, if you will, and we'll continue to use it. But public relations programs of any kind today that are interested in people's opinions, in my opinion, are wasting their time. We then moved to caring about people's attitudes because we said opinions are flighty and shifty and attitudes are longer lasting. And so we began dealing in, as you heard of my firm, attitude change and reinforcement. And then it dawned on us that what really probably forms people's attitudes and opinions is their basic belief system. And we were at a stone wall, because the psychologists all tell us that if you tamper with somebody's basic belief system, you indeed are tampering with that person's personality.
and you can hardly predict the results. Furthermore, a belief system is built up over a lifetime of living, and our ability to change is very, very tiny. So we finally got wise and realized that maybe we didn't really care all that much how people thought, other than thoughts which are expressible in behavior. I don't give a hoot how many high school graduates or adult learners think highly of my client institution. What I do care a lot about is how many enroll. And it's the enrollment that I'm interested in. And we in public relations have even let our jargon fall behind because we are not using that word, I don't think, enough or in the proper way. Our interest is in behavior. Now, from the research point of view, this raises some interesting questions. How can we get people to predict what is future behavior in most cases? It's easy enough to ask historical behavior questions. As I said earlier, have you ever taken a course? Easy. And important to know, because previous behavior is certainly some indicator of future behavior. Well, those who specialize in the theories of research have now come up with a technique which is far closer to predicting future behavior than trying to get at people's attitudes and opinions. And that is to ask people what their expectations are. Another way of phrasing that is to ask them what their entitlements are. What do you feel you are entitled to? We have recently had some good evidence that this technique works very well, and it's a real shortcut in doing research. For example, in this country, there has been a controversy over a number of social issues, including the educational issue of whether, in fact, government should supply college education, either at very low cost or at no cost. I guess it's kind of the heart, isn't it, of the private versus public college struggle. There's also been a big controversy about health insurance. Should I have to sell the farm in order to pay for my appendectomy? When we did opinion studies on this, the results were a quagmire. When you ask people how they feel in terms of their entitlements or their expectations, the results are fascinating. And neither, I think, higher education nor healthcare have paid enough attention. Because something approaching 50% of the American public on an entitlements and expectations scale feel that despite all the problems we may have economically, that a college education is the entitlement of anyone in this country. I guess only California has maybe recognized that, but that's how they feel when asked about an entitlement. We think that's a pretty good indicator of how they're going to behave on that issue if we can ever get them in a position where they can act on the issue, if we can get it out to be a public issue. On health care, something like 70% feel that national health care is an expectation, is an entitlement. When you ask them their opinions about national health care, you get all kinds of murky information. So keep that in mind. The next point I want to dwell on just for a minute is a problem that I find those of us in higher education have in presenting our research results. We are, all of us, tied to academic research. Our institutions do it. And we know that academic research has to be statistically pure, and it has